Today is February 21st, Tuesday morning at the Keep Academy. We're learning Parshat HaShavua, and this week's Parsha is Parshat Truma, but we're not going to study Parshat Truma, we're going to study last week's Parsha. The reason we're going to study last week's Parsha, which is Parshat Mishpatim, is twofold. One is because we didn't have a class last week, so we should make it up. The other reason is it's actually good to fall behind here, because this week's Parsha and next week and the next week and the next week all talk about the Mishkan, the tabernacle, the building of the tabernacle, the construction, and I probably would not find enough material to give four classes, a class for each of those 4 weeks. So being behind is actually good. So we'll spend less time on the tabernacle. As far as Parshat Mishpatim, last week's Parsha, we can spend a month or a year or a lifetime on it. There is so much there. It's the largest concentration of mitzvot having to do with civil law in the whole Torah. And almost every verse is packed full with material. To give an example, almost every verse in Parshat Mishpatim gives birth to thousands of pages of legal writings and argumentation that is still in force and it's still meaningful today. We're going to see one example of that. Two verses in Parshat Mishpatim are the foundation for Judaism's understanding of the whole issue of abortion. Of course, we're just going to not even scratch the surface, but we're going to see something. So the place we'll begin, in the sheets that I gave out, is moving to the second side of the first sheet, which has a 1 on it. We're going to look at the top, the upper right-hand corner of the second side, which has a 1 in the right-hand corner. This is the verses that we're looking at. And the reason we're looking at the verses here in my sheet and not in the JPS translation and not in the Stone Art School translation is because those two translations already translate our verse in a fashion that prejudices its reading. They translate the verse according to what we can call the Jewish interpretation. But I don't want to do that. I want to go back in time and see the verse in its pristine ambiguity and see that actually three different ways to read the two verses we're about to see. Later we'll see which of the three is the quote-unquote Jewish interpretation. So this is the book of Exodus, chapter 21, verses 22 and 23, in my brackets there in the upper right-hand corner of the sheet. I'll read it in Hebrew and in English. V'chi yinatzu anashim, and if men strive together, v'nakfu isha hara, and they pushed or they hurt a isha hara, a pregnant woman, v'yatsu yiladeha. Those two words are the important words. V'yatsu yiladeha literally means and came forth her children.
Came out.
Say it again.
Came out.
Came out, came forth. And the English here says that her fruit depart. Okay. And it doesn't say how
live or dead.
Live or dead, in what state of formation or misformation, nothing is stated. Just yatsu yeladeya.
And also it doesn't say when.
When as far as
they came out. Maybe with, they came in full term and maybe
right.
They came right then.
Right. Right. V'lo yason, and there won't be a tragedy. It says here in the English translation, and yet no harm follow. The word for harm, ason, means, in all cases that I can remember, means death, tragedy. So her children came forth, but there was no death. Anosh ye'anesh kasher yashit alav bal ha'isha v'natan biflilim. He shall surely be fined according as the woman's husband shall lay upon him, and he shall pay as the judges determine. So what that means is that in this case that a woman gets in the way of two men who are fighting seriously, and she is hurt such that her children come forth, whatever that means, the law is tort. In other words, it's not a capital case, because it says that the payment has to be made. And that's when there was no ason, there was no death. Only yatsu yeladea, only her children came forth. I put on the board there that verse 22 is a tort. Verse 23 says, V'mason yehiyeh, and if harm follows, tragedy, death, if there's death, then v'natata nefesh tachat nafesh, and you must give life for life, literally soul for soul. So that's verse 23 is a capital case, and that's when there's a ason, when there's a tragedy of death. And again, we don't know what it means, what the tragedy of death might mean. So we sit, think of the scenario, the pregnant woman who is hurt by these two men fighting. Verse 22, her children come forth, and it's a tort. Verse 23, somehow tragedy happens, and it's a capital case. And we have to figure out now, well, what is exactly going on in verse 22 when it says her children came forth? And what is going on in verse 23 when it says there was a loss of life, there was a tragedy, there was an ason? And there are lots of possibilities. I know three possibilities, three straightforward, easy possibilities. By easy, I mean easy to think of, not easy to deal with the implications, but easy to think of. So let's start.
You mean from verse 22 or 23?
It goes together.
Yeah,
so? That's what... What verse 23 means is to a certain degree a function of what verse 22 means and doesn't mean. We'll take them as a unit.
Does harm always mean death?
Yes. As far as I know.
In this.
Yeah.
But it doesn't in English. Harm means.
But the word is a son. The word is a son.
Well, in other words, if the woman is mentally injured or something, that's not harm.
The child.
That's not a son. That's not a son.
Or if she's physically injured, let's say that she's cut or suffers some physical injury, but it doesn't affect the child.
Or her.
Or well, if she's physically injured, it
that's not a son. That's not death.
That's that. In other words, that's
to be.
Okay, then the other one is, I guess...
So we have really three options. She dies, the children die, or both?
Or both live.
The men die.
Let's, I'm going to get the magic marker here. What do you say, Dishane? How can we parse this? Anyone who's reading it?
I'm a little bit confused that they get punished even though she's okay and the kids are okay.
So you're making an assumption.
What it said there...
We don't know what Yatsu Yeladea came forth her children means. But let's take the option you said.
Yeah.
Wait a second. So Deshani was making an assumption that confused him, but let's take that assumption. You said everything's okay.
Yeah.
So let's assume that you're right. Which would mean that when it says her children came forth, the tort case, everything's okay. Let's try that.
Yeah.
Everything's okay means let's try and work that out. What does it mean, everything's okay? It means that the fetus was...
It says child. Don't forget. Don't use the word fetus. Use the word child.
I understand. Thank you. The child was okay, which means it must have been a full term, and means it must have come out alive. So I'm going to write that here. There's a possibility that the child is... full term, expelled, alive and well.
What if the child is not
you have there?
Wait a second. Slowly. This is Dejanay's understanding. Let's try it.
Okay.
If that's what verse 22 means, then what does verse 23 mean?
So the two scenarios are, one is like they kind of bump into the woman and the children come out okay.
Mm-hmm.
If the children don't come out okay,
right,
then the husband punishes.
Right. So we would say that verse 23, the capital case, is that the child comes out dead. Right? So I'm just going to write. Child is expelled dead. That's a possible way of reading these two verses. Verse 22 says that Yatsu Yeladea, her children came out, right? Doesn't say under what circumstances, but it says that there's only a financial payment and
no,
there's not a death
penalty. No,
and there's not a death penalty. Yeah. There's no assom. There's no death. So that means there's no death of the children. Dishonor is suggesting no death of the children. But in verse 23, when it says there was death, that means death of the children. That's a legitimate way of reading it. It's not the only way of reading it. There are other ways of reading it, but it's a possibility.
I don't think it's a possibility because it says velo yason. It doesn't. It means there's no death period, not of the
there's
children,
harm.
Not of the wife.
Right. That's verse 22.
No, you just say the child is,
yes,
is alive.
You, have to,
you didn't say that the wife is alive too.
No, she said.
Okay. Okay. We'll write that in parentheses also.
But it says that the woman is hurt.
Is uninjured.
No, it doesn't say uninjured, just alive.
Okay, alive. The wife is alive.
It's different.
Yeah,
yes.
True.
But the emphasis is that her children went forth, and we're reading that as meaning their children are fine, but verse 23 says there was a tragedy, which means the children are not fine. The children
or
are dead.
The wife. Or the wife.
How about the wife?
Yeah.
She's that's possible, but that's a different reading. Let's move to a different reading. You want to focus on the wife? Let's focus on the wife. Okay? Let's move to option number two. So in option number two, you guys want to focus on the wife, okay?
All right, the wife is hurt. It says that.
She's dead.
It doesn't
dead.
Say anything about her.
Yes.
You want to try that she's dead? Let's see if it fits. So let's call this option number two. And when it says that there's a tragedy, you're telling me it means the tragedy is that she's dead. Fine, let's try that. So I'm going to write here, the woman is killed. Okay, so the woman is killed.
The tort would have to be that the woman is injured but not fatally.
Exactly,
yeah.
But verse 22 emphasizes that her children came out and there's no death in verse 22. So it would mean there's no death of the wife, but the children came out.
There's no death of anybody.
Well,
she could be harmed.
Hurt
is the word.
Yeah, but what does it mean that the children came out?
Alive or dead? But it's when it says below yes.
Let's try what Ilana said, alive or dead. Let's try that.
Children.
No, in 22 it cannot be like that because it says there's no son.
Why can't it be like that?
Because it says velo yason.
Yeah.
It means there's no death.
Okay. I'm gonna ignore her for a minute, okay? Let me just
can you write it?
Child came out alive or dead. And Ilana told me don't write that because it can't be.
That would be 23, yeah. Right?
But it certainly can be. Because Yatsu Yeladeya, her children came out, and it says there's no tragedy.
Uh-huh.
So perhaps it's trying to tell us that if the children come out dead, it's not a tragedy because they're not human beings. They weren't born yet.
Oh!
I'm just trying all the options, right? So let's say verse 22 is that the children came out dead, even dead, right? Even dead, but that's not called an ason. It's not called a tragedy. But verse 23 says if tragedy ensues, meaning if the woman is dead, then it's a capital case. That's another way to read the verse. Later we'll compare the different ways and see which is better.
Oh.
Let's try a third option.
Both.
A third option, I'm going to give you a hint in order to make it easy. We don't have 3 hours. We only have 2.5 hours today. Think of different, and this goes back to something Lana mentioned earlier, think of different stages in the formation of the fetus. How can I use that to divide between verse 22 and verse 23?
You can't, because it says child, and by definition a child is someone who's fully formed.
I don't know.
No.
I don't know if that's the case.
Oh, so it might be...
There's no word for fetus. So
it's no longer a fetus.
There might have been an abortion of the earlier trimesters.
It doesn't say that it says child. It says fruit of the womb.
Yeah, but we don't know what child means. It's the only word that the Torah has for what's ever inside the womb. So it could be, if we have this distinction between a tort case and a capital case, so maybe option three, when it says Yatsu Yeladeya, her children came forth, it means not fully formed. dead and not fully formed, that's why it's a tort. But if it came out dead, fully formed, then gives life for life. Let's try that, okay?
I'm going to put here, child is not fully formed, and of course dead.
But she's alive.
But she's alive. We're not talking about her.
Yeah.
And in verse 23, when it says that's a tragedy, it must be one possibility. Child is fully formed and dead.
Wouldn't that be covered by option one?
Wait a second.
Well, that's his full term.
Child is his full term.
Let me look at that a minute.
Well, by definition, if it's not fully formed, it's going to be dead. But to have a...
Well, yeah. You have two options there. If it's premature, and they take the baby out, and they have to... At that time, the baby died. If it's not here, at present day, they put it into... And save it.
Right. So let's look at these three. Let's look at these three options. Let's start with number two. The verse says, let's just see how it fits, right? The verse says that two men are fighting and that they hit the woman. The woman, what happens is that Yatsu Yiladei, our children come forth. And we're saying perhaps that means that comes out even dead. Comes out even dead. Came out dead.
And yet,
and the verse is telling us that there's no tragedy. The message apparently is that the child coming out dead is not a tragedy. Why not a tragedy? Because a tragedy is only, moving to verse 23, when the woman, who's a full developed human being, is killed. That's the tragedy. That's a possible reading. Let's put that aside and go to number one. Number one is saying that the difference between tort, two says the difference between tort and capital is fetus as opposed to human being. Number one is saying the difference between tort and capital is between a fetus that is alive and a fetus that is dead. Our children came forth alive, but tragedy means came forth dead. That's also a possibility. Number three says that it's not about fetus alive or dead. It's about fetus developed or undeveloped. If it came out fully formed dead, then that is not fully formed and dead, right? Then it's just a tort. But if it came out fully formed, like a full term, but it's dead, that's already a tragedy that you have to give life for life. All of these three options are possible. What we want to do now is ask yourself two questions, actually three questions. One is, which approach is more likely in the verse? Now, let's do exegesis. Which really fits better into the words? That's the first question. I'm going to write here, which fits better? Which fits better? Our second question is ideological implications of these three approaches. What are they? I'm going to write implications. And the third question we're going to ask is, what political figure today on the national stage in American politics represents one, who represents two, who represents three? So I'm going to write here politics. Okay? And there are people who fit in all three categories. So let's go to number one. Which fits better exegetically? Jeshne already pointed out something 5 minutes ago.
No, but this doesn't have anything to do with an abortion.
Wait a second. Stage by stage. We'll get there. We'll get there. So Jeshne said something 5 minutes ago. When he mentioned possibility number one, he had a problem with it. What was the problem you brought up?
They're okay, but the guy's fine.
And therefore what?
I don't understand why he would be fine.
Right. Disney says option number one is problematic. Because if the children came out fine, why does it say that there's a fine involved? Fine for what?
predetermined.
Well, because they say the woman is hurt.
No.
Where's the woman hurt?
Where may strike together and hurt a woman with child.
No, it's not true.
It means that they hit her with child, and we're reading it as the child came out. Fine. So what's the problem?
The intention.
The intention was to hurt someone else, not to hurt her.
They were just fighting. She was. They were stumbling on her.
So go ahead.
No, could it be for that? Because the children came out, or the child came out early, then it kind of like they have to, I guess, provide for the child before they.
Fine, right. So there could be some reason to make a payment for the embarrassment, for the pain. For what Dishani said, there's a possibility. It's possible. Okay. Let's think of other reasons to reject or accept, on the level of exegesis, these different interpretations. Let me ask you, as far as prevalence, are any of these scenarios extremely, extremely unlikely, uncommon? And which would be much more common?
I think that very first one is very unlikely. There's a lot of medical evidence that shows that preemies tend to have health problems. So even though they're breathing and seeming...
Okay, we don't know, but this is 3,000 years ago.
Okay.
But it is unlikely. One is unlikely because the verse says a pregnant woman. Mm-hmm. Number one is limiting it to a pregnant woman in the last 2 weeks of pregnancy.
Yeah.
Okay. Right, number one is limiting it to a very, very, very circumscribed case. Yeah. And the Torah didn't circumscribe, right? The Torah said a pregnant woman. If it's a pregnant woman, I think any pregnant woman. Number one says no, only a certain minuscule percentage of pregnant women. Is it talking about someone in the last half of the last month? Right? Mm-hmm. So that kind of, to me, is a strike against option number one. It doesn't mean it's impossible, but it's less likely than, for example, number two. Number two says that they struck a woman in any time of her pregnancy. Could be the first month, the second month, the ninth month, the eighth month. Just struck her, and the child came out dead. It doesn't matter if the child is this big or this big, whatever it is, formed or unformed. In other words, this one is much, much more common, number two. Number three is also uncommon. Because number three says that the verses are envisioning a scenario when it says that there was an ason, a tragedy, verse 23, the child is fully formed. Again, that's only a certain time in the pregnancy. So I see reason to say that option one and three are less likely because they're less common. And there's another reason to reject number three. Three is adding a good deal of information that's not written in the verses. Three is saying we have to divide between fully formed and unformed. Where is that in the verses? Mm-hmm. Now, that doesn't mean that one and three are impossible. It just means they're less likely. Whereas number two is the easiest, most straightforward reading of the verses. You're not adding any information. You're not circumscribing the scenario. You're just taking what it's written. A pregnant woman, any pregnant woman at any stage. So I would say that option number two is more likely. That's which fits better? I would say two fits better. Let's move here to implications. What are the implications, morally, ethically, legally, for one, two, and three? And here we get to what Sam brought up 5 minutes ago. He said, wait a second, we're not talking about abortion. But we are.
Yes, we are.
But we are. Because what we have here is accidental
abortion.
Now that's what happened. It wasn't done on purpose. There was a purpose of the men to harm each other, but by mistake they harmed someone or something else. If the law is that something is a capital case when they did it inadvertently, all the more so is a capital case if it was done purposely, and I think vice versa. If it's not a capital case when it was done inadvertently, it's hard to believe it's a capital case when it's done purposely. Let's think about this now. What are the implications of 1, 2, and 3? Say anything about any of them.
Well, the issue is when is a child considered a son, the death of a child considered a son.
When is a child considered a child?
Exactly.
That's definition of blood.
Okay, so let's talk about that. We can give a clear answer to that question according to one of these options, or even perhaps two of the options.
Well, it sounds like
only full term.
It sounds like if a doctor performing an abortion, if the doctor is performing an abortion, you don't pay the doctor, you pay the husband.
So in number two, we're being told that if an abortion occurred accidentally.
Don't say abortion, no. That's, you're changing the definition.
Miscarriage.
Well,
a miscarriage is different than an abortion.
Right.
And okay, I'll correct my vocabulary. But I'll come back to another minute.
The woman does not agree to this.
Okay, so let's see.
Exactly.
Verse 22 says these two men were fighting, they hit the woman, she fell, and her child came out dead.
Right.
And the law is that the man who did it has to pay a fine, but it's not a capital case. It's a capital case only when the woman is killed. What does that tell us about the status of the unborn fetus? It doesn't have the status of a fully formed person. So I can write here in implications for number two that, how should I write it? A fetus, killing a fetus is not murder.
All right.
Killing a fetus is not murder.
Killing a fetus. What you're reading, this was not a killing, this was
it's manslaughter.
What?
It was manslaughter.
Yeah, it was manslaughter. But it's not manslaughter because there's no
men.
Because there's no life for life. Life for life is only in verse 23 when you kill the woman.
It should be accidental killing.
Okay, accidental killing.
It doesn't matter.
It
does.
But
it's
not killing. It's not considered killing because it's not a son.
Ilan is right. Right? Accidental, but it's not in the category of life for life.
It says definitely there was not a son.
Okay, but let's consider the other option. Let's say that a person deliberately has an enemy, the enemy's wife is pregnant, mm-hmm. and he gets into a fight with the man, and one of his purposes in the course of the fight is to injure the woman to induce the loss of the child. Let's say that he's a jealous lover or something.
It's the same thing.
Okay, then it's not an accidental.
Premeditated
miscarriage.
It's going to be the same thing. I'll tell you why. Because there was intention of one man to harm the other. It wasn't completely accidental. It was accident who he harmed, but his intention was to do harm. We'll get to that in another 10 minutes on the source that I'm about to bring. So anyway, according to number two, killing a fetus is not murder. I should write the exact opposite for which of these two other options? Where is killing a fetus certainly murder?
Fully formed and dead, maybe?
Right.
Alive.
Down at the bottom.
Look at option number one. Option number one says that if the child came out
alive
full term and alive, it's just a capital case. But if the child came out dead and doesn't specify dead in what stage, it's a capital case. So number one tells me that abortion is always murder.
Right.
By killing a fetus, I won't say abortion, right? I'll say killing.
To have a problem of the definition of child.
No. Are you saying again this was deliberate attempt to kill the child?
No, just what the verses say. One man tried to hurt another man, and as a result, the fetus was expelled dead. It says give life for life.
And it's a fetus, not a child. You have to just...
But in Hebrew we don't have that distinction.
At that time they didn't...
But you say the word always there.
Make the distinction.
Okay, perhaps not always, although the verse doesn't make a distinction. But if you want, I can put that in parentheses.
Rabbi, we didn't have a word ubar in the Tanakh.
We have it in rabbinical literature.
But not in the Torah.
As far as I know.
So may I make... Okay, it's neither here nor there, but maybe using the word fetus instead of using the word child, if that's the only word that's used in Torah, it's deliberately provocative.
No, but I have no choice because that's what it means according to the different interpretations.
Child for me means it can be fully formed but unborn.
But not for the Torah.
It's the Hebrew. We have to look at the Hebrew.
Right, Hebrew doesn't
have that distinction. Now, number three, of course, is the most nuanced. Because number three says that if the child's not fully formed and you cause an abortion, it's a Torah case. But if it's fully formed, then it's a capital case. So it depends on what stage of pregnancy. So according to the implications for three, it's that killing a fetus is sometimes murder and sometimes not, depending on the level of development.
Right.
So I'm going to say...
Is fully formed made viable?
A very good question. And I'm not sure about that myself.
Of course.
We'll have to look in the sources. We're about to read. Killing...
Fully formed.
Yeah.
Fully...
Right.
Formed.
Yeah.
Fetus...
Trimester.
Is... Murder.
Yeah.
Not formed.
Yeah.
Is not murder. Right. Liz is pointing out the very problematics of option three. It's adding into the verse distinctions that aren't written there. And we have that. So how do we make those distinctions?
Then his question becomes very important. How do you define fully formed?
That's what Liz says. Before we go on, I want to go to number three here. Politics. Just to make it a little bit interesting here. Very good.
He goes to the fertilized egg.
Say it again?
Conception.
If you kill a woman with a fertilized egg, if you harm the fertilized egg, it's murder.
Okay, so Rick Santorum is on woman number one, right?
Stop the sperm reaching.
And that's what they're saying in the state of Alabama.
Santorum.
They just passed a ruling in Alabama.
In other words, Rick Santorum is involved, you can say, I'm saying this partially tongue-in-cheek, but partially not. Rick Santorum is a biblical exegete who's telling us, when you learn Parshat Mishpatim, chapter 21, verses 22 and 23, learn according to option one. Right? That's what he's saying. And he has a point. It's a possible reading. Again, I think it's a less plausible reading. That's why there's an X there. But it's a possible reading of the verses. And according to that reading, all abortion is murder. Rick Santorum. Okay, now time number two. Who holds like two? That's easy.
Obama.
This is Obama.
Obama.
President Obama. President Obama is a biblical exegete. It's Rabbi Obama, right? And he says when you read the verses, read them according to the most straightforward interpretation. That's why there's a check there. And read them straightforwardly without adding extraneous distinctions. You come to the conclusion that killing a fetus is not murder until when? Until?
It's out.
Until birth. Until birth. So President Obama is a good biblical exegete. He's reading according to the pshat, the simple reading. Now, what about number three? Who holds like three?
It's got
to
be Ron.
What's the Ron Paul problem?
I'm not sure.
Ron Paul.
But we're looking for a candidate that makes distinctions as far as how fully formed the fetus is.
Romney,
this partial birth abortion thing?
Romney goes both ways.
Okay, we can put Romney here.
That would be the libertarian view, like Ron Paul believes. He pretty much believes in making a separating the state from those kind of considerations.
No, that's what we're saying. We're saying that it depends on what stage of pregnancy. If it's the first 3 months, it's not abortion. If it's fully formed, the fetus, I don't know if it's 4 months, 5 months, 6 months, certainly a partial birth abortion, right, is murder.
Late-term abortion.
Late-term, right? But an early term might not be. So I don't know exactly which political candidate
that would
here.
Be Ron Paul. That would be minimal state involvement in this.
Stoney's not connected to minimal state. We're talking about legal definitions.
It's somebody in the middle. I'm not
someone
sure.
Someone in the middle. Okay.
Okay. Romney, you put Romney because he has all three positions.
Okay. Okay. So I hope that was enlightening.
It's fun.
And everything we did is serious. This is not a joke.
Yeah.
It's not a joke at all. And you can see there are serious implications as to how we read these verses for defining life and defining murder.
It's this not just Santorum, you know, it's the whole Catholic movement. The whole Catholic movement believes some of the whole conception.
Bishops, not the people.
The official Catholic stand. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah.
I'm not talking about lay
from
people. I know plenty of Catholics who believe that.
Yeah, but the idea that they're bringing it up as as religious freedom.
Okay, let's stay on the subject here.
They're imposing their belief
on
it.
Liz is right. Catholicism, that's traditionally taken what we've called option number one here, is based on a serious reading of verses in the Torah. And it's logical and it's plausible. It might not be the most plausible reading, but it's a possible reading.
I don't understand the general concept of Christianity. They take some verses...
No, not for now.
Just verses are...
Lana, please.
That's like classic.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, what we want to do is go back in history. We're going back over 2,000 years in history, and we want to see who held position one, who held position two, and who held position three way back when in Jewish history over 2,000 years ago. And to do that, we go to the first side that I brought for you here, the first side.
We'll also be talking about what the traditional Jewish viewpoint is on this topic.
Absolutely, that's where we're going. We cannot leave the room without getting there.
Okay.
So I have four sources on the first page here. The first two are Josephus Flavius, and I'll explain. The second is the Septuagint, and I'll explain. And the last one is Philo of Alexandria, and I will also explain. So Josephus Flavius lived in the first century of the Common Era. He was born a Jew and died a Jew. He was famous for being the Jewish general that led the anti-Roman forces in the Galil in what's called the Great Rebellion against Rome, the Great Rebellion that failed and brought about, in the end, the destruction of the Second Temple. Josephus led the Jewish forces in the Galil. His forces were overwhelmed. They were vanquished. He turned tail and joined the Romans. And he became a historian for the Roman armies and later for the Holy Roman Empire, writing books in Greek about the Jews, explaining Judaism and the Jews and Bible to the Hellenistic world in a language they can understand.
He translated the Tanakh?
He did not, but we'll get to that. That's the Septuagint. So Josephus wrote, I think, three major books. I quoted from two of them here. The first one is called Contra Opionim, and the second is called Antiquities of the Jews. It turns out that in both of these books, he's involved in exegesis of our verses, but he contradicts himself. Now, when I say exegesis, he's not directly involved in exegesis. He's simply telling us what he learned in Hebrew school when he was 15 years old. He's telling us what he thinks the Jews hold. He wasn't in a Beit Midrash. He wasn't a rabbi. He's not a scholar. He didn't investigate this deeply, but he's just bringing what he learned.
But he was your only contemporary.
He
was your only contemporary at that point in time who wrote commentary.
Except for rabbinic literature, which we'll get to later. So let's see what he writes here in Contra Opionim.
This was written during
He died a Jew,
yeah. He didn't convert to any other religion. He that kicks a woman with child so that the woman miscarries, let him pay a fine in money as the judges shall determine. That's clearly a paraphrase of our verse, as the judges shall determine. And he says it's kicking a woman with child, right? The woman miscarries. Let him pay a fine, as the judges determine, having diminished the multitude by the destruction of what was in her womb. In other words, the child came out dead, according to Josephus. But it's still just a fine. And let money also be given to the woman's husband by him that kicked her. It's clear what he holds. One, two, or three?
Two.
Anyone say three?
Killing a fetus is not murder.
So it's two. It says the children came out, and it says diminish the multitude by the destruction. In other words, the child's dead.
Yeah.
So it's not number one.
Destruction.
And he's not talking about any distinctions of term of pregnancy. He's talking about number two. So Josephus holds like number two. Josephus holds like Obama. Not bad, right? President of the United States. Let's see this other comment of Josephus in Antiquities of the Jews. The law, which is the Greek word here for Torah, orders all offspring to be brought up. and forbids women either to cause abortion or make away with the fetus. A woman convicted of this is considered a murderess because she destroys a living creature and diminishes the race.
Centaurum.
That looks like Centaurum. It looks like Josephus has gone from Obama to Centaurum. And
he's
Sam would say, that's right, Sam would say, just like Romney. Let's look at the Septuagint. The Septuagint is the translation of the Torah from Hebrew into Greek, done before the Common Era by Jews, not by non-Jews. And the translation was done both for the benefit of Jews who don't know Hebrew and for the benefit of non-Jews who want to see what the Jews believe. The Septuagint. If two men wrestle, so this is the English translation of the Greek translation of the Hebrew of our verses. If two men wrestle with one another and hit a pregnant woman, and the child comes forth and is not fully formed yet, then the penalty shall be a monetary penalty. But if it was formed, then thou shalt give life for life. Say it again, which number?
Three.
One, two,
three.
That's three. Mm-hmm. That's three. So you see that 2,000 years ago, all three exegetical options were on the table. All three. Fascinating.
Well, three says child is fully formed. This says, and it's not formed yet.
No, that's it. Three says child is not formed.
Not formed. That's
talking
about verse 22.
That's right. A translation of 22.
Let's look at Philo here. Philo of Alexandria was the leader of the biggest Jewish community in the world outside of the land of Israel, of Alexandria. We're talking about the end of the first century of the Common Era. He was a philosopher, a thinker, a biblical exegete. We don't know if he knew Hebrew. There are lots of indications that he didn't even know Hebrew, and that he studied the Septuagint and not the original text. What is certainly clear is from hundreds of examples that Philo was not part of rabbinic tradition. He didn't have the traditions of interpretation that the rabbis of the land of Israel and the rabbis of Babylonia had. He had an independent understanding, and that might be related to the fact that he didn't know Hebrew. Look what he writes. But if anyone has a contest with a woman who is pregnant, and strike her a blow on her belly, and she miscarry, if the child which was conceived within her is still unfashioned and unformed, he shall be punished by a fine, both for the assault which he committed, and also because he prevented nature, who was fashioning and preparing that most excellent of all creatures, a human being, from bringing him into existence. But if the child which was conceived and assumed a distinct shape in all its parts, and received all its proper connective and distinctive qualities, he shall die. For such a creature as that is a man, whom he has slain while still in the workshop of nature, who had not thought it yet a proper time to produce him to the light, but had kept him like a statue, lying in a sculptor's workshop, requiring nothing more than to be released and sent out into the world. So Philo's making distinction between fully formed and not fully formed. He's going with number three, which is simply a function of the text he was using, the Septuagint, that makes that distinction. He might not even known that the original Hebrew didn't make that distinction. And again, we see that all three options are on the table 2,000 years ago. But of course, the important question for us is which of these three options was adopted by Jewish tradition, by rabbinic tradition. And I'm not going to say the answer until we read the sources. We have 15 or 20 minutes. Mm-hmm. But what I will say, that in rabbinic tradition, there's no argument. Not only no argument, there's not even any echo of an argument. Rabbinic tradition only knows one of these three options. And I'm not telling you which one. But rabbinic tradition doesn't have any arguments on this issue. It doesn't know the different options presented in the extra rabbinic literature we just saw. It only knows one of them. The question is it window number one? Is it window number two? Or is it window number three?
Door.
Big door.
So we're going to read rabbinic sources now. on the back side of this page, the page that's called page one. Now, these sources are extremely complicated. I'll make it as simple as I can, because rabbinic sources usually don't address the principle directly. They talk about implications, and you have to figure out from the implications what the principle that they're assuming is. So here we go. We're looking at the Mechilta of Rabbi Yishmael, Masechta Dinizikin, chapter 8.
Is it really written by Rabbi Yishmael?
It was from his Beit Midrash, his Beit Midrash. And the Mechilta is the Tanaitic, Halachic Midrash on the book of Exodus. When I say Tanaitic, I mean from before the year 200 of the Common Era. When I say Halachic, I mean legal and not non-legal. And when I say Midrash, I mean exegesis. So this is from before the year 200, and it's the rabbinic exegesis on the book of Exodus. It says as follows. What then is the purpose of saying if men strive together? The Hebrew is ummah, tamud b'mar v'chi yinatsu anashim. In other words, what is the point of our two verses? Why is it written? What does it come to teach you? What does it come to teach you that you would not know otherwise?
That's an accident.
Say it again? Well, no, it doesn't give an answer yet. We just asked the question. Answer. The question is, why are our two verses written? Right? Is something wrong with the sheets
no,
there?
No, there isn't. It's the way you staple this particular sheet.
Okay, so why are two verses written? What's the legal point that you wouldn't know? And then it goes on to say, because it says, and he that smiteth anybody mortally, Leviticus 24:7. In other words, there's a verse in Leviticus in the book of Vayikra. In Hebrew it says, v'chi yakeh kol nefesh adam. And it goes on to say, mot yumat will certainly die. It's not quoted here, but I'm telling you what it says in Leviticus, were we to open up. In other words, there's a verse in Leviticus that already says that anyone who smiteth anybody mortally, the word in Hebrew is kol, any soul. If you kill any soul, it's a capital crime. If that's what it says in Leviticus, what do our two verses add over and above that? That's the question. And the answer is, which I might understand to mean, even if he kills a child born after only 8 months of pregnancy, etc. In other words, our verse comes to limit the definition of the crime that's found in Leviticus. Leviticus says, anyone who kills any, I emphasize any soul, any nefesh, is liable for the death penalty. You might have thought that that includes even killing a child born after 8 months of pregnancy.
Which is three.
I'll explain. Wait a second. In other words, you would have thought, and you really should hold on to your chairs here, because this is kind of disconcerting to many people, you would have thought that if there's right here on the table a child born already, don't think of the scenario on the board, born already, a child was born 2 weeks ago, and I know that it was born after only 8 months of pregnancy, so that 9 months have not yet passed since conception, and it's right on the table right here, you would have thought that if you kill it, you're a murderer. Why would I have thought that? Because the verse Leviticus says, anyone who kills any, all people, nefesh, is a murderer. You would have thought that if you killed the child, you're a murderer. Our verse comes to tell us you're not a murderer. Even though the child's already born. Already born. Because 9 full months of pregnancy have not passed. Let's read it. Therefore it says, and if men strive together, etc., 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 thereby telling us that one is not guilty of death unless he kills a viable child. What does viable mean? Viable means a child that's born without deformities, such that we know it will live, because we know it spent 9 months in the womb. That's what a viable child means.
You just added a caveat. You said without deformities.
Yes.
First time you mentioned that.
Yeah, because that's what the word means in Hebrew. Ben Kaimov, let me explain. This is complicated. We're being told that we learn from these two verses that you're only considered to be a murderer when you kill a child that is born after 9 months of pregnancy. That's what the rabbis are saying we learned from these verses. That you're only a murderer if you kill a child that spent 9 months in the womb. So now the question is, how do the rabbis get to that conclusion from our verses? And I'll say that question slightly differently. Which of the three ways of reading the verses could bring us to reach this radical conclusion that the only time you're considered a murderer is if you kill a child after 9 months of pregnancy? Does that fit at all with option one? Does it fit with option two? Does it fit with option three?
Yeah, two of them.
It only fits with option two. It only fits with option two. Because if you hold option one, well then you hold that killing a fetus is always murder. So you don't need 9 months of pregnancy to be considered a murderer. If you take option three, the same thing. If it's fully formed, but not necessarily after 9 months of pregnancy, you're also a murderer.
Oh.
The only way the rabbis could have reached the radical, and I say radical conclusion they reached, is if they read our verses like number two. They read our verses like number two, they assume number two, they don't even challenge it, they just assume that it's to be read like number two. Remember, we said number two is the most plausible, exegetical reading, and it tells us, the verses tell us, if we read them like option number two, that killing a fetus is never murder, unless it left the womb. And the rabbis learn from that, that if 9 months of pregnancy have not passed, even if the child has left the womb, it's still as if in the womb.
It can't be fully formed unless it's 9 months. That's what they're saying.
Well, they're saying it might look fully formed, but it's not viable.
Right.
It's not viable. In their medicine, it's not viable unless it's spent 9 months in the womb.
So technically...
How do they know exactly when the 9 months was?
Yeah.
Good question. In other words, that's just theory. That doesn't really matter.
Exactly.
Yeah, but that doesn't matter. I mean, that's just a question of technicalities. We're not interested in applying this. We're looking for the principle.
For the very principle, not for the offensive ones.
Let's look at the last source on this page.
But also, isn't there somewhere that says, like, once it leaves the womb, it's still alive?
Yeah, so it's in here.
Oh, it's
but we'll have to say, according to this, that that's only if we know that it spent 9 months in the womb. And we'll get to that in another few minutes. So look at the source at the bottom of the page. The source at the bottom of the page is involved in a very, very technical discussion of who is considered to be a human being. Just for example, it says a girl 1 day old, and she is subject to 10 different or 8 different biblical laws. And it's just telling you that the minute a girl is 1 day old, she's considered to be a 1 day old human being. I said that wrong. The minute a girl is 1 day old, she's considered to be a human being. Then it says, and I have this in brackets, a boy 1 day old. And it has all these laws that I didn't put in brackets. And it's just telling you that from the minute you are 1 day old, you have, you're considered to be a human being.
23 hours old, you're not a human being, right?
Thank you, Jim. The rabbis don't mean that. They mean 1 minute old.
All right.
And the minute you're born, we don't say that you become a human being at certain stages of 30 days or 30 years or bar mitzvah, anything else. 1 day old, all of these laws apply.
Assuming you're breathing and everything else, too.
You're alive. And one of the implications is, as you see in my brackets at the bottom of the page, he who kills him is guilty of murder.
Right.
Like a full grown.
Right, so the point is, for this source, that you never say that a child is not yet a human being. A child is a human being. Doesn't matter if he's 1 day old, or 5 days old, or a month old, or 5 days, or 12 years, or 20 years. It doesn't matter. We don't have all those distinctions.
Wait a second.
The point is in that direction. In other words, we don't wait until a certain point to say that the child's a human being. That's the point of the Mishnah. But for our purposes, we also see the other side of the coin, which means before 1 day old,
he's
not a human being. He who kills him is guilty of murder only from 1 day old. Jim?
No, I mean, the question, of course, is it the umbilical cord cut or not cut? When does that happen?
I don't know the distinctions.
But there are some if and buts.
But we'll see a different source. We won't have time for it. It says when most of the fetus's body leaves the womb, roe, majority, that makes it one day old. But before that, even if 90% of the fetus is in the woman's body and 10% is out, it's not born yet, and if you kill it, you're not a murderer. That doesn't mean that we're recommending you go about killing fetuses, right? It just means that it's not in the technical category of murder.
It's interesting that we can inherit.
Yes. So, since time is short, let me tell you what the next source says without reading it. The next source says that our Mishnah that we just read, that says that from one day old, if you kill it, you're a murderer, that only applies if you're certain that it was a full-term pregnancy, in accordance with the first source.
Yes.
But if it's one day old, but you know it wasn't a full-term pregnancy, but so it's only 8 months, then you have to wait 30 days until the killer becomes a murderer. If you know it spent only 8 months in the womb, and then someone kills it after birth, it's still not murder. Because if it didn't spend 9 months in the womb, it's not considered to be viable, not considered to be a human being that's going to exist and live. So after we said all that, and again, there are lots and lots of sources I brought here that only scratch the surface, I want to summarize 1,500 years of halakhic development on one foot. So it's like this. From the sources we saw, and this is absolutely true, it's considered to be an axiom that we learn from the biblical verse that the child enters into the category of nefesh, so that if you kill it, you're guilty of murder only after birth. Only after birth. And what we today call abortion is never going to be fully and absolutely in the category of murder. Hmm. That's clear in a thought without any argument. I'll just say that once again, that killing a fetus that's not yet born is never going to be in Jewish law considered to be full murder. On the other hand, that doesn't mean that abortion is permitted. It just means it's not murder. Is abortion forbidden in Jewish law? Jewish law makes it clear that abortion is forbidden, but not as murder. Rather, as what? What is it if it's not murder,
tortious,
if it's forbidden?
Conduct.
Sit in?
A tortious conduct.
It's a tort, but what is the crime? So, one major opinion,
a tort
of the
by definition can be a crime. Think about it.
It's forbidden for me to punch you in the nose, even though it's only a tort, but it's forbidden. What's the crime? The crime is called bodily injury. Bodily injury, as the definition of the crime of abortion, is one of the major definitions that the rabbis use in the following sense. It's forbidden for me to punch Tony in the nose. It's also forbidden for me to cut off one of Tony's limbs. In the same sense, it's forbidden for me to punch myself in the nose. And it's forbidden for me to cut off one of my own limbs. In the same sense, it's forbidden for a woman to cut off one of her limbs. And the child is one of her limbs until he is born. That's one way that the rabbis look at the definition of the crime of abortion as a crime of self-mutilation, which is forbidden. Another way of looking at it is that abortion falls in the same category as destruction of semen. Just like a man is not allowed to spill semen, and that's a crime, it's not murder, all right? But it's a crime, it's forbidden in the same sense. Some rabbis say that's the definition of the crime of abortion. It's a continuation of the crime of spilling seed. Seed that's obviously more developed, but it's the same basic category. Those are the two primary ways of looking at it. There are many other ways, but those are two primary ways of looking at it.
If it's because nefesh?
Thank you. The point is as follows, that in Jewish law, there are only three crimes that are immutable. Only three crimes that one is always forbidden from committing them. They are murder, idolatry, and sexual licentiousness. Any other crime there are always circumstances under which you're allowed to commit it. If there's a higher value to be gained, you're not allowed to kill anyone, even to save human life. But you're allowed to commit many other crimes to save human life. You're allowed to cut off your own pinky to save your life. It's called surgery, right? You're allowed to spill seed to save human life. There's a lot. Almost every crime in Jewish law becomes permitted, or even a mitzvah, under certain circumstances.
So you can't kill someone in self-defense.
Yes,
you can, but I can't go into all the... you can't kill an innocent person to save your own life. But you can kill a guilty person, but I won't go into all the details there. So again, to make a long story short, since Jewish law never considers abortion to be full murder, but rather a lesser crime, therefore, abortion becomes permitted, theoretically, under certain circumstances. What might those circumstances be? That's obvious again. That's saving life. There's a case of rape. There was a case in the 18th century in which the rabbis discussed a woman who said, "If after rape, if I give birth to this child, I'll go insane by living with the memory of the crime," and it was allowed by the rabbis. There are cases of course, deformities. We know the child will not be able to live a full life, won't be able to live a healthy life. Such as are considered by the rabbinic deciders, since, again, abortion is not murder, it might be permitted under certain circumstances. Rape, deformities.
Incest.
Say it again?
Incest.
And there are also cases of serious psychological issues that might be caused to the mother as a result of economic issues, or again, the rape, the incest, complicated stuff. Now, how do the rabbis go about weighing this? Well, it depends on the needs on one hand. How bad is the possibility of insanity, of psychological stress, of economic stress? On the other hand, how do we define what the crime is? Is it spilling of seed? Is it self-inflicted mutilation? And the third issue, of course, that the rabbis deal with, as you might expect, is the term of the pregnancy. Not related to what we have on the board. Taking number two, that abortion is not murder, but if it's a crime, well, it might be a different crime at different stages of the pregnancy. In general, we say that less than 40 days of pregnancy, the fetus is water, and halachically, it can almost, under most circumstances, be terminated. Then we reach, of course, the first trimester, which becomes more serious. We reach fetal movement, which becomes more serious. And we reach the beginning of the birth process, which is even more serious. But in all these stages, there are different rabbinic factors that are weighed. So it's always very complicated. It's always very nuanced. And ends up that the Jewish position, although there are certainly distinctions among different rabbis, it's not Obama, and it's not Santorum, and it's not Romney. It's something that you can't reduce to a soundbite. And it's something quite complicated and nuanced.
So what do you do with contraceptives?
In general, contraceptives are not considered to be spilling of seed, and contraception is in general permitted, except for the type of contraception that is the spilling of seed, which is a condom. But besides that, there's not any prohibition in and of itself. Again, this is a different issue. I'll just say parenthetically, contraception is not an issue in and of itself, like in the Catholic Church. It's an issue simply of preventing oneself from fulfilling the commandment of being fruitful and multiply. And then we have to judge how many children you have already, etc.
What's the view in Israel of all of this?
Well, first of all, people want to leave because we're beyond time, so certainly.
Thank you.
I understand. What's the view in Israel?
Yeah. What's the law in Israel?
You mean the civil law?
Yeah, the abortion laws, the civil laws of Israel, presently.
As far as I know, and I'm not an expert, abortion in general is permitted, but it has to go through a committee, an ethics committee, that has a rabbi in it and has a social worker.
Not really.
Oh, no?
Okay. No. No, even it doesn't even need the parents' permission.
So,
but it needs the committee's permission.
How can get an abortion?
No, somebody told me that actually she's in your community, that when she got an abortion in Israel, it was totally legal. And it didn't even need the parents' knowledge.
Okay, I don't know, but it could have gone through the committee.
Maybe, yeah.
I don't know.
No rabbis were involved.
She might not have known about it.
I mean, by Jewish law, not by rabbinic law.
Yeah, but she might not have known that the committee signed off on the abortion. There's certainly a case when people don't know that why the hospital was allowed to do it.
Really?
But, so theoretically,
but again, I don't know. So I don't know.